You are listening to Haunting the Studio, a podcast about horror, the ways it crosses media, and the borderland where fiction and reality melt. Join us as we, your hosts, Tyler and Andy, plunge into nightmares, both real and imagined, to understand how the different presentations of horror work in different ways, and perhaps gain some insight into why we scare ourselves. We are hosted, nestled even, in the loving arms of Radio 1. And because of that, especially if you're a fan of Radio 1, you might recognise these voices. Once upon a time, we were Haunting the Studio, a show about horror and heavy metal. In that form, we took different guises. I wasn't Tyler, I was Dr. Rot. And my co-host here, Andy. Say hi, Andy.
Hi, Andy. Solid joke.
Thank you. Wasn't just Andy. They were Professor Flesh. But in this new form, we're giving the genre its due. Because we aren't just talking about music anymore. We're talking about horror in all of its forms. We want to discuss film, not just for soundtracks, but for the films themselves. And books and video games. Art. Fashion. And even the crossover into when horror becomes real. To begin with, for this inaugural episode, Andy and I are going to simply be discussing some of our experiences with horror. We'll be discussing the various forms that horror takes, both in the real world and in the fictional world, and how those different forms affect us. But first off, I think I'd better properly introduce my co-host here. Andy, how are you feeling?
I am feeling very well, thank you. How exciting it is to be back in the studio.
Once again, we're haunting the studio, but this time around, we're haunting a whole lot more.
Yeah, and you know, how wonderful it is for you to have me on. You must be so elated.
Absolutely. Couldn't do it with anyone else.
I'm very excited to be exploring all of the links that exist between, different works of art, and they really are that art, but they, of course, they don't get considered in the same way, which is absolutely a travesty, in my opinion. There are some incredibly important works of art that are neglected because they exist in the space of making people viscerally uncomfortable, tapping into primordial senses that trigger anxiety and apprehension. And people don't want to experience that. Sure, they'll experience deep sadness in, a drama or the, heart racing pacing of an action film. But the quiet, suspenseful building, the meticulous detail that goes into creating these stories and how people still can relate to them doesn't get explored as much as I believe it should.
I think you're right. I think film is the area where this is the most pressing. Some of the most lauded films, at least of the post-war era, in fact, no, the entire history of film, are horror films. And yet horror itself is probably one of the genres most underrepresented in Oscars or other awards given out to film for and the immense impact they have, on a year-by-year basis, sure. But still, it's the sort of thing that sets a benchmark for what's considered the acceptable, what's considered artistic, what's considered the best of the best in terms of the film world. And yet, in spite of the fact that you'll find entire seasons of Oscars and Golden Globes and BAFTAs where very little in the way of horror comes up, and yet, if you traipse through the history of horror, some of the most groundbreaking films ever made, from the original Dracula and its Spanish cousin that I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, right through to the likes of The Exorcist and jumping forward to the current wave of indie-tinged folk horror sweeping the world at the moment, or at least for the past few years, you'll find all sorts of not only groundbreaking in terms of horror itself, but groundbreaking in terms of the medium. In terms of film, if you go back to some of the earliest horror films, way back in the 1910s, you do find a lot of interesting little bits and pieces here and there, impressive little attempts at new techniques. Things like the first adaptation of Frankenstein, that Thomas Edison's film company made in 1910 have some pretty stunning special effects for something that was within about 15 years of the start of the industry. And that's true right throughout. There's this kind of freedom that making something that draws such a visceral reaction gives you. What's been your experience with horror films?
My experience with horror films goes back to childhood. You know, going to the video store, and one of the films that my sister and I used to get out a lot is Monster in the Closet, which I'm surprised my parents let us watch because there is nudity in the first 10 seconds. But we used to get this film out, and we loved it. We thought it was brilliant. We had so much fun watching it. But when I got a little bit older, horror really started to get to me, and I was very scared as a child, or as in a slightly older child. But I still love, you know, as much of a joke as it is, Goosebumps. You know, they introduced a lot of ideas to kids surrounding horror. And now when I look back on them, I realize that there's actually very little difference between, you know, Goosebumps and Arthur. Because, you know, there's always a lesson that gets taught. Mm. You know, if it's about, you know, like The Haunted Mask, which is about self-respect and, you know, the love of the family can protect you from so much. Mm. And you know, you should be thankful for the family that you have. And, you know, these, like, lessons exist in all of the Goosebumps. But we never think of those shows as the ones that teach kids good stuff. Probably, yeah. Because it does take a little bit extra.
It's something that's true of pretty much all, you know, fiction made for children. But definitely, if I think about Goosebumps, I don't really think of the lessons. I think of the covers, probably first.
Yeah, the covers.
Which were always great. I absolutely love those. As a kid, I also was honestly really repulsed by horror. And that continued up until probably my early teenage years. Something that was a little bit alluring, but, you know, it scared me. But Goosebumps I always loved. And I think on top of being this kind of interesting and almost unique, there are a few other series like Goosebumps, but not very many. Almost unique way of kind of teaching those childhood parables that you get from all sorts of children's media. The other thing is that they kind of introduced probably a lot of people our age, people who were children between probably the late 80s and 2000s, to a lot of the classic horror tropes. There's one that I remember quite distinctly that is pretty much just Phantom of the Opera. It's the exact same thing, except I believe the phantom in that story is haunting, I think, a school gymnasium or a school theater or something like that. But the same thing is true of a ton of those books. They're introducing these old figures that haunted our parents and grandparents and even great-grandparents' imaginations to this brand new audience. And, you know, I think I owe a huge debt to R.L. Stine in that sense, because for a long time that was kind of the only horror I would engage with. And definitely once I hit teenage years, I started to properly re-engage with horror, partly through music, because I got really into hard rock and heavy metal, and there are plenty of horror tropes that run through both.
Yeah, we built a whole show around
that. We built a whole show about that. And then another thing, just like going to the library at your school or the public library and seeing those, you know, Goosebumps covers, the super colorful pastel illustrations of these things that scare children, is going to the video store, which is something that doesn't really exist anymore now. But going down the horror aisle and seeing the various covers of films that, you know, you'd never heard of, like Friday the 13th Part 8, or some you know, film with such a low budget it may as well be an indie film about vampires or eating yourself or something like that. I think there was a great mix to them as well. Like, you'd see these kind of visceral and splattery and, you know, gruesome covers for a slasher film, but you'd also see, you know, that kind of old-fashioned art for some reprint of the Hammer films or the Universal horror films, because, you know, when I was a lot younger and there were still VHSs, there were tons of VHS reissues of those films that came out. Now, I can remember seeing all these different depictions of Dracula from the 30s or from the 60s, or Frankenstein's monster from the 30s or 60s, or the Mummy from the 30s or 60s, because Hammer retread a lot of that territory and kind of just reintroduced it for new audiences. And there's something about that kind of not really knowing any of this. It's the same for walking down the aisle of your school library or walking down the DVD store or the VHS store when I was a kid, where you'd see these kind of like one-off representations that are there to get you to pick up the book or pick up the DVD and rent it or get it out or buy it, but still kind of surround you with this kind of miniature wonderland of all of these terrifying weird things that you don't fully understand yet. That's something I miss from being a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember particularly the Leprechaun films. Loving the covers for those.
Absolutely.
Which, you know, I think it's a marvelous series. Although I have to say I'm yet to get into, was it Leprechaun Into Hood?
Yeah, that's the sixth one, I think.
Yeah.
Or Leprechaun Into Hood 2.
I love that there was a second one.
Yeah, I think those are sixth and seventh, but I can't exactly remember.
But also, you know, seeing how different genres of horror have different tropes for their cover art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was something that I wanted to mention earlier was, you know, for as kind of little regard that horror gets when people talk about cinema, there has still been a lot of work, and there is this entire canon around like the horror genre that doesn't exist with other types of film. Like, you know, you usually don't get subgenre of romantic comedy. They're just called romantic comedies. And the same thing, you know, for drama. Whereas with horror, you get these really minute distinctions and all of these tiny, you know, subphylum.
I think you do get them with other ones, like you get historical dramas and period pieces and whatnot, but there's definitely something to be said for the extraordinary particularity of horror. The way you can take slashes, which is already a subgenre, and then periodize them to decades or to particular movements like Italian Giallo, that it kind of mirrors heavy metal, which can be lasered down into these niche little sub-scenes that themselves exist within an extraordinarily niche sub-scene. A tiny little grouping of people that amounts to a handful of bands, but still is its own little particular group with a particular sound and a particular look. There's definitely, you know, a mirroring there between the two. Trailing back a little bit to film, it wasn't until I got surprisingly older, until I started watching horror movies. There are a handful that I watched as a teenager, but it wasn't until I kind of got to university where I really threw myself into that world. Part of that is because as a teenager, I kind of picked a handful of films that were my favorite and didn't really watch that much else. And, you know, you get to university and you start expanding your tastes, or you just get out of high school and you start expanding your tastes in line with expanding your interactions with the world. Was it the same for you, or did you kind of really throw yourself into horror cinema a little bit earlier?
No. For me, I took a while. It took a while between, like, you know, loving Goosebumps and stuff before I started watching horror movies when I was older, because I watched like Scary Movie when I was like 11. It was Scary Movie 3, and I remember that like scene when they're under the house and Cindy like bends over and there's, I think they call it Tabitha in Scary Movie. Cindy bends over and there's the girl from The Ring standing behind her, which really freaked me out. Then I was like nervous to be alone in places. But then once I got to high school, my sister, who was a little bit older, had a boyfriend that loved horror. So they went down to the video shop and they got out a couple of Friday the 13th films.
Mm.
And we sat and watched those, and I loved them. And then every time we went to the video shop, I'd go to the horror section, and I would just grab piles of them. And I'd come, like, you know, walk up to Mum with, like, 8 films in a stack. And she's like, we're getting 2. One for you and one for your younger sister. It's like, well,
I want 8.
I want 8. You know.
Yeah, that's definitely something I remember from being a younger teenager was, you know, getting movies to last, like, a couple friends staying over for one night and going out with the intention of getting maybe 2 and coming back with 6.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... Oh. Video shops are great. I miss them.
I miss them too. There's a particular experience to not really knowing for sure if the thing that you want is going to be there.
Yeah, and...
But still having all of these other things.
And, like, building, you know, a relationship with the person who works there. Mm. I used to, when I first moved out of my parents' house, like I used to go to the United Video that was near my flat a lot. And, you know, we started to get to know the people that worked there. And then it closed, and now it's just Sally's. Sally Army's.
Should still be a rental.
Should. It really should.
But. Really should. That's an entire realm of interacting with film that's before you even get into the films. Kind of like discovering them, being shown them by an older sibling or an older friend, going to the DVD store and seeing the covers and that sort of thing. And then you get to the actual watching the films themselves.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, there are a few. When I was a teenager, I had a girlfriend who was into horror, and I watched Martyrs with her, which...
Good film.
Yeah, good film, but hell of a film to watch.
As a date.
As a date, yeah. But I also, you know, there are a few films like the remake of My Bloody Valentine that came out maybe 10 odd years ago.
With the guy from Supernatural.
Yes, exactly that one.
Yeah.
In 3D. So, you know, I watched that. And there are a few other films like that that I remember seeing because friends put them on. The remake of Piranha 3D, I watched that at some point. A lot of these aren't, well, barring Martyrs, a lot of them weren't very good films.
Yeah.
But then I got to university, and immersed myself in slashes and got really into black and white film. I got into film from the 60s, the Hammer films. I got into the kind of experimental 70s era, the early slashes, and, you know, the kind of jaded and cynical 90s take on horror, you know, after Scream, essentially. And I kind of threw myself into all of it. And there's kind of a different feeling for all of these different things. There's a very obviously nostalgic for the really old films, but this very classical and demure and I guess I call it upright feeling to a lot of the Universal films, a lot of which I've been rewatching recently. And last night I watched The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr. and Claude Rains. They present horror quite often through people who are very upright citizens of the world. Dracula is this aristocrat from far away. Larry Talbot is the son of a kind of a wealthy manor owner. Dr. Frankenstein, of course, is a learned man of his profession. The Invisible Man is an inventor, etc., etc., etc. And it gives this kind of very classy feel to a genre that is not usually described as classy. Whereas if you compare that to, say, those early 70s proto-slashers and early slashers, you have this grimy feel that gets underneath your skin. If you're watching, say, one of my personal favorites, Black Christmas, which is usually considered one of the earliest slasher proper, there's this unnerving energy to the villain of the film, Billy, who you never really see. Billy is kind of a name that the other characters give him. He doesn't really talk. That really just crawls underneath you. He's a very unnerving figure, precisely because you know very little about him, and so he doesn't really have any kind of motive. The same is true, but in a very different way, for, say, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where there's a very clear motive. The family are cannibals. They're attacking these people mostly to eat them. That's just part of their lifestyle. That's how they live in this remote and desolate part of Texas. But there is a similar griminess to it, where you know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. In fact, they do it in broad daylight. That's part of the terror of the film, is that it takes horror out of the night and into the day, where those things don't really hide in shadows anymore. They can get you anywhere. The light isn't really safe anymore. But there's a very similar griminess to it. These people have an understandable motive, but how they got there is still confusing, almost infuriating. Because you know it could just not be like that. They could just not eat people, but this is how they live and this is how they choose to do it. So all you can really do is hope that the victims survive, at least one of them. And, you know, usually there is, you know, this the final girl that crops up throughout a lot of horror, especially since about the 70s or 80s. But there's usually, you know, a victim or two who will survive, whether they've been altered by their experience or whether the film doesn't really bother to address that, is down to a film-to-film basis. But nevertheless, they all have a very different feel to them. The same is true for, you know, Hammer horror films in the 60s or the cynical 90s films or, say, Japanese kaiju films, which have their own entire backstory to them with the horrors of, you know, experiencing atomic war. There's a way in which horror gives you very, very different feelings based on the era and the type of film you're watching. And I guess that is true of all cinema, but horror is just so broad. And the thing is, there's this entire smorgasbord of experience, but all of it is still there to scare you and to get under your skin and to make you feel things that you don't actually usually go out of your way to feel. Which I think for cinema, that's kind of my allure to horror. Especially when we're talking about something as direct as kaiju films, there's this kind of, I consider it like a distorted, you know, carnival mirror held up to society, you could say, as much of a meme it is to say that these days. It's this kind of carnival mirror held up to your own experiences and how you sort of operate in the world that still, in a way, tells you something about kind of the world it's trying to reflect. That was a long spiel on my part.
It was great, though.
I really felt like I could fully see your reasoning behind, like, your love of these films.
Mm.
And, you know, there are a lot of great films that you mentioned. For me, the horror films that I really loved were, you know, the kinds of ones that had huge franchises, like the Friday the 13th one, which has dozens of films. Nightmare on Elm Street has heaps of films as well.
Halloween.
Yeah, Halloween.
Leprechaun.
Yeah, I guess. Saw as well.
Yeah.
I do really enjoy the Saw films. I think they're fun.
It's kind of one of the last bloated franchises.
Yeah.
In a way.
It's
there are a lot of Paranormal Activity films, but I think there are about 5 of those in the end. Saw, there are like 10 of them now.
And, you know, there was another one that was supposed to come out, I think, at the end of last year that had, was it Chris Rock?
I'm not sure.
I need to fact check, actually.
I remember Jigsaw
coming
out, and I knew there was another film going to come out, but I didn't know it had.
Yeah. You know, I think that the Saw franchise, it sits at this really interesting crossroads between they want to make something with, like, an in-depth storyline with a chronology that isn't linear. So, you know, the films take place at different periods of time.
Mostly so they can bring back Jigsaw.
Mostly.
Yeah, I forget the name of the guy who plays him, but I think they just want him.
Yeah. But also, you know, there are things that happen in certain films that don't get explained in that film, but get explained maybe 2 films down the line.
Mm.
And they do work pretty hard to make this really interesting kind of storyline. I'm not sure it always works in its favor. You know, as much as I love watching them, and, you know, under no pretenses that, yeah, they're not the perfect films.
Yeah.
But I think there are some really interesting ideas that they play with in them, particularly the first one, I think, was a really effective, suspenseful film.
It's very different to the rest.
It is. There are, you know, a couple of traps that you see. It's mostly 2 people in a room, and it's about their relationship. And
it's a much more genuinely psychological film than the rest, which play it being psychological, but mostly look at this extraordinarily elaborate trap.
Yeah. Actually, three people in a room.
I think it would have been really effective as a stage play. I know I said that, back when we were doing Haunted in the Studio, I want to repeat that opinion again. I think it would be a really interesting stage play to have these people on opposite sides of the stage and learning about each other and, you know, how they're related, which in the second one as well, there's, everybody that's in the trap together is related.
Socially related, not by blood.
Particularly one event kind of ties them all together.
That is something that is one of those things that kind of crosses the borderlands. All of the scenes that take place in that one room feel like a stage play. And of course, that's not the entire film, although it is a hell of a lot of it. It's kind of the main driving force of the film is what happens in that room. But you're right. If you took that and perhaps made us somewhat different, like, you'd have to kind of rewrite it. You couldn't just retread the movie exactly. I think it would be a really good stage play if you kind of remade the film but filled in scenes elsewhere by keeping the entire thing in this single set. It would be, I think, a very interesting stage play to watch. You know, one of those things about horror is that it doesn't have to be something that actually crossed over. There are plenty of examples of foiled attempts at something crossing over. There have been a handful of attempted Hellraiser games, which never got off the ground. And I believe there still hasn't been a Hellraiser game.
There were two Saw games.
There were two Saw games. I do know about those.
That were absolutely panned. And when they were developing them, I remember before the first one came out, and I was watching, YouTube videos where they were, showing it off at E3.
Mm.
And they were saying, we wanted to have the same, suspenseful atmosphere as, Silent Hill. We want this to be, the next Silent Hill video game franchise. It did not take off. They weren't that great as films. There was some...
Much as Silent Hill's transition into being movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I was saying before is that they don't even have to be things that actually crossed over. You can still see, you can envision that crossing over just in the content of whatever piece of art you're looking at, whether it be a film or a book or music. As concept albums are famously kind of just films that they couldn't get made into films. But I mean, I guess the most famous kind of crossing over is the inspiration for a lot of films, which is books. And I know for both of us, we probably haven't read as much horror literature as we've watched films or listened to music, but there's still read enough that there are particular things that really grip me. I'm a big fan of Lovecraft. I quite enjoyed a few of the classic horror origin stories, the original Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and the original Bram Stoker's Dracula. And I'm also a fairly big fan of Junji Ito.
Oh, I love Junji Ito.
Yes.
So exactly. Good.
The adaptation of Junji Ito to the silver screen didn't really work that well, but notwithstanding. The origin point of kind of the entire film genre is in literature. That was still true well after the Universal period. William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist became The Exorcist, for example, and Clive Barker's Hellbound Heart becoming Hellraiser, as well as God knows how many Stephen King books becoming films. If you kind of trace through that lineage of horror film, you come back to horror literature, which of course you do. Predates film. It also predates a lot of the music we listen to, and it certainly predates video games.
Yeah, by a long shot.
And being so long before pretty much all of the other mediums we might talk about, barring music and paintings and whatnot, and theatre, but in terms of the media that we most interact with today, given that the classics of horror are so long ago, there's once again that close interrelation between fiction and real life. Of course, when we talk about Frankenstein, there's always that debate about whether Mary Shelley had based it on various experiments that were taking place at the time. There's that famous story of one Italian scientist who was using electricity to manipulate the limbs of deceased animals, I think frogs is what he was working with, and other such similar stories as medical science was beginning to figure out how the neural system worked, how, you know, electricity carries between different parts of the body and sends information and whatnot. And the same is true when we discuss Dracula most of a century later. We have an instance where the common story is that Dracula is based upon the famous Vlad the Impaler. Whether or not that's true is one of those things that's up in the air, but nevertheless, we draw these kind of lines between real life and fiction. And that early point of horror literature is one of those places where, you know, it's a very potent melt between the two. Reality and fiction are very close together, especially with Frankenstein, because at the time, you're talking about not quite the Enlightenment anymore. This is, you know, after kind of the transition point of the Enlightenment into the Industrial Age. But you were still talking about that point in which medical science, and in this case anatomical science, is making these great leaps and bounds into the unknown. And there's this genuine, legitimate fear that something like Frankenstein's monster maybe could be real, because people are experimenting with bodies and finding out you can make them do things after they've died and other such unnatural phenomena that maybe or maybe not, maybe man was meant to be able to do these things, maybe he wasn't.
That research for a long time was completely forbidden.
Yeah.
It was something that you weren't allowed to look into, and so that led to this huge industry of, like, grave robbers. And also, when people were hanged, then being auctioned off, you know, to people who wanted them for their experiments.
For a little while, Mary Shelley even lived not far from one of the squares where these public executions were taking place in London. And there is a bit of a theory that part of the inspiration for Frankenstein was the tussles and sometimes perhaps even riots that would break out between medical practitioners auctioning for the body of the recently condemned and paupers in London who didn't want this final indignity to happen to the body, who for religious reasons or simply moral reasons thought that this shouldn't be happening. It's, you know, the real world colliding with fiction. That's something that carries through all media. Countless slashers are based on real-life serial killers, of course, and there's any number of supernatural films that are loosely based upon quote-unquote real experiences of people. There's even the entire realm of war horror, with films like, for example, Death Watch from 2002, which is a personal favourite of mine, setting a incomprehensible horror scenario within the already horrible circumstances of trench warfare on the Western Front during World War One.
Another film that was based on, you know, things that were happening during war was Jacob's Ladder, which was about experimentation with chemical weapons that were being heavily researched in the conspiracy theory that turned out to be true, MK Ultra,
which then spawned more conspiracy theories after it was shut down.
Yeah. You know, there are documents that detailed research that was undertaken on civilians and, like, apartment complexes that had their water laced for people to study the effects. And, you know, Jacob's Ladder is about one of those soldiers during the Vietnamese War that their platoon was experimented on. You know, and without spoiling too much, is also explores a lot of the struggles of returned servicemen. And readapting to civilian life after seeing countless unparalleled traumatic events, especially with the ferocity that was displayed during the Vietnamese War. With any war, you know, they talk about war being hell.
It is kind of one of the greatest hells that we're able to visit on Earth. Not only the sheer ferocity of it, but the sheer scale of it. It's something that an individual serial killer or a cult can't do. You can destroy an entire region, condemn entire populaces with war. That's something that the largest cults can do on a small scale. but certainly can't do to an entire region. They can do to a township, maybe, but not to a country. And obviously, a serial killer, even the worst of them, can at most terrorize a town. Or an area. But they can't really do it at the same scale.
You know, we mentioned before the translation of horror from one media to another. And we touched on video games, which absolutely is a very, very interesting conversation.
Which is the one you've been itching to talk about the most.
It pretty much is, yeah. I love video games. I love horror video games. And there's something about playing a video game that you just don't get with watching a film because you're an active participant.
Mm.
And you're in control of your character, but you're not in control of the situation. We talk about the fear of the unknown is one of the biggest, you know, primal fears that we have. And
the entire underpinning of cosmic horror.
Yeah. Is just how vast and unknowable everything is. And we're actually existing on such a small scale to be basically insignificant. And that's contrasted with domestic horror, which is, you know, explored in completely different way, which is when the familiar becomes dangerous. And, you know, that could be a family member. I think Babadook is a very domestic horror. And one about grief, how you know, letting go of the parts of life that get irrevocably altered because of personal loss is a really difficult thing to navigate. I know a lot of people really don't like that film for its portrayal of mental illness, but I do think it has some really, really interesting ideas that it explores, but I accept that it isn't for everybody. But getting back to horror in video games, not having control over the situation is incredibly nerve-wracking. And you know, one of the most effective horror series, I think, at the moment is Five Nights at Freddy's.
God damn it.
I do. I really do think it is effective.
No, go on. Have your spiel.
Yeah. So, you know,
here I am being highfalutin, talking about universal horror films from the 30s.
And here I am talking about... Yeah, but no, it's picks up this idea of, you know, the creepy animatronics and people in suits from children's play centers. Yeah, Chuck E. Cheese is kind of the biggest one for the animatronics.
Mm.
And turns them into these unstoppable machines that there is no way that you can control them. You can watch them get closer.
You're a passive survivor.
Yeah.
At best.
Yeah. And then there's also managing the resources that you have of power. And when the power runs out, there's nothing that you can do. When the power runs out, a music box starts playing, which is another, you know, childhood elicitation of these jovial, kind of sweet melodies.
It evokes a similar feeling to, say, the first Child's Play movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Of something very childlike and familiar to someone who's meant to be very young that in turn becomes dangerous and unknowing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the story of Five Nights at Freddy's has evolved over its... What are we up to now? 8 games?
I lost count many games ago.
8 games. There are going to be 10 books and potentially a film. I'm not sure.
I guarantee you that's going to be in development hell for a long time. That's going to come out like the that's going to come out like the Slender Man film that came out like 10 years too late.
Oh yeah, and like absolutely kind of abandoned some of the ideas that were set up by the canon of particularly 3 big horror YouTube series that established the canon of Slender Man: Marble Hornets, The 12th Tribe, and Everyman Hybrid. These 3 long-running, they span multiple years, that established this canon of the Slender Man. And then the film just ignores some of it. Like the unpredictability of everybody experiences Slender Man differently. Oh, they also don't call him Slender Man in Marble Hornets. They call him the Operator. One of the things that one of the characters did was he became obsessed with drawing, like, a head and then crossing it out. And that was the symbol that he associated with this faceless entity, which was only ever supposed to be for him. But in the film, like, it's everywhere. I have opinions about the film, and they're not good. It's not good.
One thing to be said for horror video games is that there's a very clear divide in the kinds of horror. You have on the one side, usually the more survival horror type games, but also something like, say, Doom, where you're either a passive or an active survivor. With Doom, you're Doom guy. You're this almost invincible kind of warrior for humankind against the forces of hell. For something like, say, Clock Tower, or I'll pick a more familiar game.
Yeah, because I don't even think I've heard of Clock Tower.
Silent Hill. We'll say Silent Hill.
Yeah.
You are, for the most part, a fairly passive survivor. And especially once you get to the survival horror genre of the last 10 years, something like Outlast, where you're an entirely passive survivor, entirely on the run the entire time. You know, another one would be Amnesia: The Dark Descent. But also, you have games where perhaps the horror is you. Take a game like, say, the first Postal, where you aren't a passive survivor or an active survivor, you are an active participant. And that is something that you get in horror film as well, where you kind of take the side, as it were, of survivors, and you are a passive witness to their survival. Or in some films, where there's a bit more, say, glorification, or at least a bit more sympathy to the side of the perpetrator of the crimes, you become a passive observer to the crimes rather than the survival of those crimes, to the perpetration rather than the, you know, the survival. And that's something that you'll find in video games, because there are, definitely not as common, but there is kind of a realm of spooky or horrifying games where you are either looking over the aftermath of what you've done. That's probably more common than being the active perpetrator of crimes, is taking the perspective of someone, usually after a bout of amnesia or something like that, or at least you, the player, rather than the character, not knowing exactly what's happening right from the get-go. You take possession of someone who has done something horrible, rather than taking the perspective of someone who has survived, or perhaps not survived, that horrible person's crimes. But that's something that is very different in video games, because you have to take that more active role. You are surviving. It's on you, the person engaging with this art, to make this character survive. Or if you are taking the perspective of someone who's doing some terrible thing, then it's on you, the person playing it, to be the one to do these things, or to grapple with the aftermath of these things being done. Which I think the latter is probably a bit more common, taking the perspective of someone who has done something terrible. That's a, you know, not to spoil anything, but that's a big motif in the Silent Hill games, is the aftermath of a terrible act. And that's something that you don't really get in any of the other mediums, I don't think.
No, I agree. I think it's...
Did I steal your thunder?
A lot, yeah.
Sorry. I have a lot of thoughts, okay.
I do too. Yeah. But yeah, horror video games are just as varied as, you know, horror films. And so much of what makes effective horror of any kind is ambience. And the qualities can't really metrically describe how all of the details of, you know, a game or a film fit together. And Silent Hill has a really good example of that with its soundtrack. You know, Silent Hill is known for having some really beautiful musical moments. Very pensive, kind of slow-moving melodies that will build up with layers and have these beautiful textures. And then it will directly oppose that with, like in the first game, where it starts off silent until you pick up silent to Silent Hill, until you pick up the radio, which clues you into enemies being near, which is just this unnatural, inorganic, industrial sound. And, you know, a lot of, you know, whirring sounds, a lot of metallic scraping and static, just the sheer harsh noise tracks that populate the soundtrack. Also contrast with long periods of silence. You know, in the second game, there's a really effective moment where everything is silent for a really long time, and it builds up this suspense of when is the sound coming back? That isn't just my footsteps.
When is the levee going to break?
Yeah. And eventually you hear scraping metal, which if you've played the first game, you'll recognize as the very, very famous, very well-known Pyramid Head coming up behind you with a giant sword that is so big that it has to basically drag itself around. And interrupting that silence unexpectedly with this metal grinding noise is so effectively done. I absolutely take my hat off to the composer who has done amazing work on building this soundscape. And this very recognizable soundtrack, both for its industrial harsh noise as well as its beautiful, melancholic, sometimes even serene soundtrack, which will just use, you know, some simple piano notes. And add to the storytelling in a marvelous way.
I mean, you can go further back. I mean, I don't think you can quite say the same for, like, the Atari 2600 era. But when you get to the 8-bit, and especially the 16-bit era, is when you start to have soundtracks that really build into the feeling of the game. I'm a huge fan of the Castlevania games, and they have these incredible, swelling, triumphant soundtracks to them that put you in the mindset of this brave person facing off against a menagerie of horrors from the past. Or Doom, which Doom famously, the soundtrack mostly being loose covers in 16-bit of various heavy metal songs from the prior 10 years. But, I mean, I can counterpose that to a game like Splatterhouse, which was another 16-bit era game that has this, befitting the game itself, which is drenched in viscera and gore and bits, has this almost squelching soundtrack that makes you feel wet and sticky in a very uncomfortable way. That perhaps is something that you could say is a bit closer to Silent Hill, in that the soundtrack isn't just trying to draw an emotion from you, it's part of the general feeling of the game. It's part of its setting. And that's something that, of course, is drawn forward and become something widely emulated across the horror genre in video games, is Silent Hill's capacity to make the soundscape part of the landscape, as it were, part of the storytelling. Not that there are terribly many games that have done it as well, but it did kind of set the benchmark for how exactly this thing is meant to be done. This kind of draws us into the one thing we've been kind of orbiting and not quite touching on, which is music, the MO of our previous show. kind of something that is part of, not literature, sure, although plenty of times I'll be listening to something befitting the mood of a book I'm reading, but is definitely an integral part of both video games and film. And of course, pretty much any other, well, most other digital or electronic sort of visual art, music is a part of that. Even going back to the silent era, because you would have usually a live orchestral band playing in the cinema to provide the soundtrack to what you were viewing. A very old crossover between those two mediums, those two media, two art forms. But of course, it's not just as an accompaniment to other forms of art that we listen to music in the context of horror. You and I both know that there is an enormous array of music that in and of itself is designed to give you the feeling of horror, designed to elicit certain emotions out of you. One of the albums that I think we both enjoyed the most in the old show that we covered is Diamant de Glace, Litanies of Satan.
I love it.
Which I described at the time as the soundtrack to tumbling into the pits of hell when your sins catch up to you, you know, after you've exhaled your final breath. Truly an incredible feat of human tolerance when it comes to, you know, using your voice.
Yeah. You know, we talked about this on the show, but she likened doing a performance as getting ready for war. And it's a battle, and it requires this level of fitness, vocal fitness and breath control, so as not to cause damage, which can be so easy. And there have been, you know, countless singers whose careers have been ruined because of not paying close enough attention to their voice.
We've discussed in the show the unfortunate malady that a lot of especially early death metal vocalists who caused tremendous damage to their vocal cords, and in a few cases wound up contracting throat cancer caused by how much damage they'd done to their lungs and vocal cords. And that is another example of not only horror, which death metal usually is not always, but it usually is some form of horror or another, but also a kind of extremity in music, pushing the voice to do things that it shouldn't really be able to do.
Yeah, and I think very few people are able to really show exactly how much the human voice is capable of than Diamant de Glace. I absolutely adore her work, especially Litanies of Satan, which you'll remember when we were listening to it in the studio, I basically just sat down with the headphones on.
Yeah, at no point did we discuss what we were listening to. We didn't really take any notes, which is that we'd usually at least discuss what we were listening to while we were at break with the music playing to, you know, sort of get ourselves ready for the conversation we'd have once we come back from the album. But with Diamant de Glace, we both sat there, we had the nice, good quality studio headphones on, and we just kind of
absorbed.
Let ourselves be taken by glass voice.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that kind of pressing extremity to get across feelings or get across the sense of a certain kind of horror.
One piece that we didn't play on the show, though I definitely wanted to, was a track by the experimental band Current 93 called I Have a Special Plan for This World, which is a spoken word track that the words were taken from a poem that was written by Thomas Ligotti, who is a poet, novelist, and philosopher that's known for very depressing topics.
Yes.
he himself suffers from anhedonia and has for a very long time. Anhedonia being like symptom of mental illness that just makes somebody incapable of feeling joy. And, you know, that track goes into some dark places. I think it's absolutely brilliant.
It's exceptional. I don't, you know, it isn't just the case that these kinds of extremity are necessary for horror music as well. One album that I really wanted to do and that we didn't get to was the Lizzie Borden album Master of Disguise, which is a loose adaptation of Phantom of the Opera. But one of the few examples I could think of an entire album, you know, ensconced in horror from the hair metal genre, which that's not really a depressing genre. You know, you listen to hair metal to drink with your buddies and
to get ready for a party.
Yeah, to get ready for a party or to party too.
Yeah. Yeah, have a line of Molly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think for them it was mostly cocaine.
And heroin.
Cocaine and heroin. But, you know, it's not a genre that you'd really associate with horror. And yet, I think it's a really good album. I think it evokes feelings of horror while still having plenty of triumphant tracks and ballads and kind of tracks that you're meant to be able to party to, all of which is, you know, familiar fare for the hair metal genre. But it still works. And it's, I think, a testament to how varied horror is. Sometimes it's something that, as a, you know, I've said it too many times already this episode, but gets under your skin. It's something that terrifies you. It's something that evokes primordial feelings. Other times it's just fun.
Yeah.
It's campy. A lot of those Universal horror films are like that now. At the time they were, you know, much scarier than we would take them at this point. But if you watch them today, a lot of them are, on top of having a lot of stellar moments, very campy and enjoyable.
Yeah, and one of the albums, apart from Domanda Glass, that was probably my favourite, was by The Darks of the Hillside Thickets.
Mm.
We did their album, The Dukes of Alhazred, which they're a Lovecraftian rock band. Everything that they do is based on Lovecraft. And it is one of the best albums I've heard in my life. It is so much fun. It, you know, from the very first track.
They're one of the few of any kind of adaptation of Lovecraft that I would describe as having a laugh with Lovecraft.
Yeah. And, you know, they carry this, like, sense of fun over as well to their live performances. They're really well known for having these, you know, really out there costumes. Kind of like how Gwar have their costumes, but, you know, they're having
probably less gross.
Yeah, far less gross. Because it's fun.
Mm.
And it's all about having fun. And it's wonderfully, wonderfully portrayed in the music. You know, from the very first track on that album, which is You Fool Warren Is Dead, which has an incredible guitar riff. And, you know, it carries this energy on. And even the last track, We're Gonna Kill a Chupacabra Tonight, is so much fun. yeah, that was absolutely one of my favorite albums. We gave that, I'm pretty sure, like, collectively the highest score that we did.
If you checked the
Radio 1 website, we did give them scores, but we didn't do it on the radio. I think we might have done it once or twice.
We pretty much just did it after the fact.
Yeah.
But we gave that one, I think, an 8.5 out of 10. Out of 10, maybe.
Well, I gave it a 9.5 out of 10.
I think we must have given it a 9 collectively.
Yeah.
Which we did tend to score very high. I think the lowest score we gave was like 6.5 or 7.
Yeah. Trying to remember which one that would have been.
I'm fairly sure it would have been Haunted Garage.
Yeah, I was thinking Haunted Garage.
You weren't really a fan of it. Although that is another case of something steeped entirely in horror, but in the campy element of it. That album is entirely oriented toward fun.
Yeah.
Whether that particular kind of goofy, trauma-influenced crossover thrash is for you is kind of down to the listener, as is all music, but I think especially so with Haunted Garage. But it's definitely something that aims at being fun, but at the same time still evoking a lot of those feelings of horror, just in, again, a different context. It is good that you bring up Darkest of Hillside Thickets album, because that is, again, one of those crossovers. It's a direct adaptation of the works of Lovecraft. And I brought up a direct adaptation of Phantom of the Opera before, of which I'm not sure if there's ever been a game of Phantom of the Opera, but there have certainly been other adaptions to literature. There are a number of films, both much looser adaptions like Dario Argento's opera, and then much more faithful adaptions like the two Universal versions from 1925 and 1943. And of course, through to stage, Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical.
Yeah, which definitely did a lot more to make it seem more romantic.
Mm.
Which, and like, you kind of get to the end of the film when, you know, you get the sense of, oh, he wasn't a bad guy, he was just misunderstood. No, he impersonated a dead girl's father to manipulate her. And then isolated her from everybody. And it was really messed up.
There are a lot of...
He was not a good guy. He was a really bad guy.
A lot of the more romantic adaptions of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Because we remember that in the early days, Hunchback of Notre Dame was a much more horror-oriented character. Certainly a very tragic one.
Yeah.
That carries through. But he is a bit more monstrous in early depictions. The first adaptation to film is considered one of the earliest classic Universal horror films. Their version from, I believe, 1923, starring Lon Chaney Sr., the Man of a Thousand Faces. And it's a certain malleability to horror that goes along with the sheer gamut of what it covers, from the campy right through to the very extreme. And I think that malleability is... it's part of what makes it alluring. And it's part of what allows it to slot in with other things so well. Especially if you think about films, think about Predator, one of the classic Schwarzenegger, tough guy action films. I'm pretty partial to a lot of Schwarzenegger's 80s work. I get into it, I enjoy it. But that's...
Was it Kindergarten Cop?
Yeah.
That was fun.
A true classic. But it is a... Predator is a horror film. For sure. That's also a classic action film. It starts off as a war film. And there are plenty of other examples along those lines. There are plenty of horror comedies that make light of a lot of the tropes of horror. One of my favorites is Young Frankenstein, the early Gene Wilder film from the early 70s.
I really liked Black Sheep, a New Zealand horror film. That was really fun and really campy. And also played with a lot of those... ideas of like animal experimentation and uncontained biological threats and has a lot of fun with it. Also another New Zealand film, I Survived a Zombie Holocaust, which I was in.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was a zombie extra.
I did
in
not
the, like,
know that.
Final scene. I'm pretty sure I've still got like the trousers and shirt that they gave me to wear.
I'm gonna have to try and pick you out next time We have to watch that when we go home.
Oh, it would be pretty hard. There were hundreds of people there. It was... and we all, like, came out of alleyways from on King Edward Street. I wasn't close to the front.
Well, that's something I can't say I've done. I haven't been an extra in a horror film.
It was really cold. The fake blood that they used was mostly corn syrup.
Sticky.
Yeah. And they would just like, okay, stand here. And then, like, people got handfuls of it and they just, like, threw it. And I wasn't prepared for how cold it was. We had to go down at, like, 5 in the morning.
That makes sense.
We decided, because I went with, like, a group of friends, we decided it would be better if we just stayed up all night. It was a bad idea. It was a terrible idea.
I think it would make you suitably haggard.
Yeah, but also it meant that I fell asleep and then woke up and my friends had like moved somewhere else. And so I just woke up on the floor alone. But yeah, and another like campy, fun New Zealand horror comedy film.
Yeah, and another one of those crossings over. It's quite literally real life for you.
Yeah.
You were part of that. You did that. And the end result of it is the horror film. A horror comedy, sure, which is kind of New Zealand's forte, but a horror film nonetheless.
Yeah.
A lot of horror also crosses over into romance, which you brought up with Andrew Lloyd Webber's version of Phantom of the Opera. You'll also find plenty of more romantic, gore, even erotic depictions of Dracula. who is, at his core, a horror character. In the book, it's unequivocal that he is this nightmare from the past coming to haunt the good enlightened people of England. But there are plenty of versions of him that really play up him being sexy or romantic or alluring.
Some of them are, he's really sexy.
Got a personal thing for a old mate.
Bela Lugosi.
Christopher Lee.
Oh, who also was a metal musician.
Also was a metal musician.
In his 90s.
Mm.
Didn't he release his like first album on his 90th birthday?
It was something along those lines.
It was like a power metal concept album.
He released a two-part power metal double concept, like not in the same release. This was like a year apart or something. His kind of main thing with his band was this two-part concept album about the life of Charlemagne, the Frankish emperor from the 8th century, I think 8th century, which, you know, good for you, Lee. I'm fairly sure he won an award for, I think, best first-time performance or, like, an up-and-comer award at one of the big, like, metal awards, kind of award ceremonies for that year.
I love Christopher Lee. I think he's great.
R.I.P. One last thing. Well, we're still talking about horror and its various fictional media. Is horror kind of a lifestyle? Because you have goth as a lifestyle, which is very, very close. Not exactly the same, but very close. The same with emo, which, again, you know, some people will just call those two the same thing, but I'm sure there are purists out there who would get very angry if you did.
Oh, neither of those people would be happy with being lumped in with either one.
Exactly.
It's kind of this weird, like, it's like how no new metal band likes being called new metal.
Mm.
Or like how no emo band likes being called emo.
Yeah.
But then they'll like tag themselves as emo on Bandcamp. It's like, pick one.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's tagging themselves as new metal on Bandcamp.
I've never looked. I've definitely looked for emo and I've found some great bands like The World is a Beautiful Place and I'm No Longer Afraid to Die.
I think we know what we're going to do when we get home now.
I absolutely know what I'm going to do. I'm going to load up Christopher Lee Dracula.
But yeah, it's again one of those crossover things. The same with heavy metal. Plenty of metalheads are fans of various eras of horror. Rob Zombie, famously. Originally a metal musician who went on to direct a lot of horror, and in his music days there was plenty of plain visible influence from those, you know, black and white 30s, 40s, 50s era films in his presentation. The big metal baby looking thing that he used to bring on stage comes from a horror short from the, I believe, 20s, the Phantom Ghoul, I think. Phantom Creep. There we go. The Phantom Creep. The big metal creature that he would bring out on stage and appeared in music videos. That was something that he drew originally from the Phantom Creep serial that ran in the 20s. One of the classic but a bit more obscure silent era kind of horror, I suppose, franchises. So there was clear influence of horror, but I'm not sure if I'd ever say that horror itself is a lifestyle. And the weird thing about that is I can picture a horror person in the same way I can picture, you get like an image if you think of a goth. But yeah, there are kind of these archetypes of people who are into horror, but they're not quite a horror archetype. But the thing is, I can think of the image of someone who is kind of the classic horror fan. Someone with, I can picture the posters on their wall, I can picture the kind of things they do when they hang out, I can picture just the kind of guy. I get the image of Matthew Lillard's character in Serial Mom, and to a lesser extent, his character in Scream. There's, you know, a kind of guy in that sense, you know, at least with regard to Matthew Lillard. But there is a kind of person that I can imagine when I try and think of a horror lifestyle, but there isn't quite the horror fan. There are goths, there are people who are fans of horror, but they fit into something else.
I think it really is a discussion about aspects of culture. And horror fits in really well with a lot of these subcultural groups of...
With misfits.
Yeah.
It's a Misfits genre.
Yeah.
Literally.
I'm wearing a Misfits shirt right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I fuck a puppet.
The Misfits.
You know, very much like cultural activity for metalheads and also for goths and emos and scene kids and
for bookish kids.
Yeah.
As well.
And also a lot of just teenagers in general. It's a really fun group activity is to go see a horror film in the cinema.
Is to be scared or, together.
Yeah. You know, it's experiencing you know, this emotional range with other people, and it's a very different experience watching, you know, a horror film with your friends and watching one late at night with, you know, headphones on and, you know, alone, which is how I watched Martyrs, which I decided to watch at like 1 a.m. recently. Yeah. which, you know, I imagine would have been a completely different experience to watching it with friends, because that's a it's a group bonding exercise. It's something we love doing with other people.
It's not quite a lifestyle per se, but it's an integral part of lifestyles, plural.
You know, so the discussion's very much about, you know, cultural activities. Horror media is also something that is informed a lot by the culture of the people who are making it. You can definitely see differences with horror that's made in different countries. So for, you know, for New Zealand, we love making comedy horror. And, you know, making a lot of really dry jokes. What We Do in the Shadows, really dry, but it uses the classic vampire characters, and then shows how everyday life would be for vampires, you know, and funny little jokes like how they can't look in the mirror to see how they look, so they draw quick pictures of each other to show them. And there's that great scene where they go to like the Monster Mash, and you know, there's this like hall full of people, and you know, they're dancing, having a great time. Then the camera pans around and looks at the same room through a mirror, and there's just the one human that's just on their own dancing around, which is really funny. And then you kind of contrast that with, you know, Japanese horror films. Japan is known for making supernatural horror films and very gory horror films. And kaiju films.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I'm going to use Ju-on as a really good example, which had a remake that was
in the US,
made in the US, but had the same director and had a much higher budget than the original film. That used cultural ideas of haunting. The design for the spirits in the film were taken from traditional Japanese theater, where people would paint themselves this very pale blue. And pale colours are very common for their spirits. Which, of course, it's a thing, you know, pale white ghosts are a very common thing. But these weren't transparent. They're very much physical. And they don't... I mean, there are some, like, shadowy creatures, but for the most part, just how real they are and how bizarre they kind of look with how they're painted that very pallid blue. For one, it makes them scarier, but it also came from their cultural practices in theater. And then you contrast that with their very gory horror films. Those films have a very interesting kind of place in the horror canon. You know, for instance, the Guinea Pig series. I'm pretty sure it was the Guinea Pig series. Charlie Sheen from Two and a Half Men phoned up the FBI once,
thinking that it was real.
Yeah. No. No, they weren't. He was just high as hell. he had just been on a bender. But that is a reputation that, you know, those kinds of Japanese horror films do have, is that they're incredibly shocking and they do them incredibly well.
That is a point. They have their particular and perhaps unwanted niche in the horror realm, and partly because what else do you call them besides horror? I think with films like Guinea Pig or other films like that, they aren't really presenting horror. There isn't really a storyline running through them. There's just a horrible act. But it isn't trying to evoke something relevant to some particular way in which you are scared. A slasher usually brings forth the fear of serial killers and maniacs being next door. There are plenty of films with some kind of haunted or spiritual narrative are playing off of the folklore of wherever they were made, and you can go on and on and on. The 90s ones that I brought up before very much are rooted in the cynicism of the 1990s, whereas these films are not really trying to evoke anything per se. They're kind of just presenting you this detestable act and leaving it at that. And there's kind of a question as to whether that's even really horror or if it's something else. The third part of Japanese cinema, not that there's not plenty of other things to draw out of Japanese horror, it's a very rich region of horror, is the kaiju films from the 1950s right through to now. Although the ones from the 50s are kind of the ones that immediately come to mind. And those are very, very clearly rooted in the aftermath of experiencing atomic war. You watch damn near any of them, and the effects of radiation or the effects of nuclear testing are usually what brings forth the monster in question. Godzilla is drawn forth because he's blown out of the water, essentially. Other ones are created from radiation. A similar fear in the US that led to all of those films that would be killer giant ants or killer giant spiders or whatever else have you.
Also, The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah, a much later one where that deals a lot more with the direct effects on people.
Mm.
But you're right, there's a different cultural background to how horror films are made. I think that's even true of American slasher films in the 80s, which, you know, I think most people would write them off as being entirely decultured, as not really having a root in anything. But I personally think that the excess of 80s Americana, of commercialism and consumerism and whatnot, are kind of what underpins it, because most of these, at least the most well-known characters, and I'm particularly thinking of Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger, are these kind of larger-than-life, almost mascots, more so than horror villains. When I think of Jason Voorhees, I don't just think of the films. I think of toys that were made about him and kind of the specter of the hockey mask wielding killer, but being used to sell cereal or something.
Yeah.
And Freddy Krueger is, you know, borders on being a comedic figure. Towards the end of the original series, he is a comedic figure. But he's one that kind of exists in this bright and flashy and bigger and better every time world, which was true of both series. In both cases, the budget grew with every single film. This was definitely true of Friday the 13th, which the first one was made almost as an indie film. It had a very small budget. And when you get to the final one, in, I think, 2002 was when Jason X came out.
Jason X!
It had the biggest budget of them all. It had ballooned from what had originally been in 1980. I, you know, get the feeling that these are characters of their time and place. They're characters that become, in the case of Jason Voorhees, almost physically bigger every time. They went from various people playing him in the second film, where you get, you know, the Jason Voorhees proper, and the third film, where he gets the hockey mask and becomes the Jason we know and love, until you get to when Kane Hodder played him, who was a fairly well-known stuntman at the time, who was the only person to play Jason Voorhees multiple times. Kane Hodder is a fairly big guy, and the character of Jason Voorhees literally got bigger and buffer and more present with every single film.
Look, they would have gotten Andre the Giant by the end if he had, you know, how long, just that little bit longer.
I would have loved to have seen Andre the Giant in a slasher film.
Yeah, I would have.
That's a lost future right there.
Yeah.
One last thing, I think, before we get to the end of this, where I kind of want to talk about horror in the real, as it were, is art. Because that is, paintings and whatnot are kind of the oldest cultural form. And if you talk to metalheads or goths or people who are lovers of horror as a culture, there are names that you'll hear. H.R. Giger, and if they have like a kind of classic-y, old-timey artist they really love, it's usually Hieronymus Bosch.
Oh, so good. I love Hieronymus Bosch.
I'm a personal fan of, and I'll butcher his name, but the Polish painter Zdzisław, whose artworks evoked a kind of sorrow at the loss of the two world wars and have this skeletal dissolving feeling to them.
A lot of his paintings, he uses cyanide blue, which in the Second World War, that was they used cyanide in the chambers. And as a result, the walls were stained from the original white painted to blue, which is why it comes up a lot. A lot of his depictions are of like the machinations of war represented by bodies. And these huge structures, you look closer and they're organic.
My personal favorite painting of his, and both a lot of them are untitled, and also I just don't know the name of this one, but it presents kind of a valley in which you are kind of looking down the entrance of the valley, but the steep cliffs are clearly the unnaturally fused corpses of soldiers. It's my personal favorite by him.
Yeah. There are other artists that, you know, I really love. I love Francis Bacon and his works. There was this original triptych that he did, which just had these really kind of bizarre-looking creatures, one of which was standing on, like, what looked like a giant scrubbing brush, you know, one that you'd maybe wash floors with. And then like later on in his career, some of the final works that he did were recreations of that with his style now, which started as viscera, that was quite amorphous, turned into something that was more stylized, which showed a really interesting progression in his work. Also, I love the works of Goya. He was particularly known for his black paintings, which he had painted in a house directly onto the walls, features my favorite painting of all time, which is Satan Devours His Son, which is this gruesome, horrid work that was, I'm pretty sure that was painted in the dining room, which was a place to have it. And all of the like versions that we see now are actually reproductions, because it was painted directly on the wall and that house was demolished a long time ago, which is absolutely tragic. You know, I really wish that that could have been preserved. And a more recent artist that I discovered when I was in high school was Chet Zar. Though you might not know his name, you are familiar with his work. If you've ever seen a Tool music video, any of the clay animation ones, Sober and Prison Sex, I'm pretty sure are like the two ones that he did. He directed the music video for Spiders by System of a Down. He did character creation and prosthetic work for the Hellboy films. And also he created animatronic babies for ER. I'm pretty sure. I need to actually double check that one.
I'm going to choose to believe that.
Yeah. he also has a series of paintings, you know, where I don't know his name. It's too Polish for me to figure out. I apologize, Poland, but I have difficulty reading.
That's all consonants.
It's, yeah, there's a lot of Z's. Like, it's fun to look at, but I'm...
It's like Welsh, but with Z's instead of Y's.
Yeah, yeah. But where he did landscapes, Chet Zar does portraits. And he's got a lot of characters that, you know, combine the inorganic with the organic. So, you know, character that their face is, you can tell it's their flesh, but it's also a gas mask. And my favorite work of his is a very simple like concept, but it has this very ethereal look. It's called Black Nerve Administrator. That is this spindly, spidery kind of figure of wiry black shadow on this amber background that it's so, like, bizarre to look at, but it is a really effective horror painting. It gives a kind of sense of dread in a way that I don't understand. And, you know, that's my favorite work of his.
Going right back to almost the start of what we were talking about, part, like, one of the first things that will draw someone into horror is the covers of books or the covers of, you know, DVD or VHS cases or the covers of video games, or that's, you know, for all of those things kind of less so, well, barring books, but less so today. But there is a kind of classic art of especially the kind of cheap paperback horror that you will get a lot of from the, I guess, kind of 50s through maybe 90s. And, of course, had its roots in going all the way back to penny dreadfuls in the 19th century. But also kind of like the Fantastic Worlds kind of early sci-fi publications of the 20s and 30s. That's one of those things where a lot of the covers of old school cheap paperback slashes or reprints of classic films, you would happily get as a poster. They look awesome, they draw you in, they allure you, but they're almost copy, but, you know, drawn instead of written. They're kind of just there to draw you in to rent the VHS or to buy a paperback at a Whitcalls or whatever. But they are kind of in of themselves as kind of, you know, integrally related art. The same is true of the covers of CDs or vinyl, just album art in general. It's almost an integral part of the experience. You listen to an album, and if you're like the sort of person who will just sit and listen to an album, often you'll be looking at the artwork the whole time.
Yeah. You know, there's that old adage, don't judge a book by its cover. Except the cover should be an inseparable part of the art. The art of the book, or the art of the album, or film. It's meant to prime us as the viewer, as the reader, as the listener, to what we're going to expect. And you can take a really, you know, artsy approach to it. You know, thinking of, for instance, like the cover of Slither, which was a comedy horror film, a pretty good comedy horror film.
Some really great practical effects. Especially for a film that's, what, like 15 years old, maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that. Some absolutely stellar practical effects in the era where CGI was kind of king.
Yeah, definitely. You know, thinking of, like, the bloated woman in that.
I particularly love, I forget what his name is, but sort of the main antagonist who goes through the transformations throughout the film is he.
His character's name is Grant Grant.
Okay, Grant Grant.
I can't believe you forgot that.
I'm not going to lie. The only time I've ever actually watched it was probably only a few years after it came out, so it's been a long time.
Oh, same. I haven't watched it since I was 14.
Okay.
I'm sorry. We can cut that out. That didn't need to be said.
Yeah, so my social security number is. But yeah, so I particularly love the because he goes through so many transformations without the film, which is something I always love in any kind of body horror. It's the same with, say, The Fly. Like, one of the things that
David Cronenberg's.
Yeah, one of the things that makes the film, you know, a classic for so many people, I think, is the incredible attention to detail and how much Jeff Goldblum transforms throughout the film.
Yeah, and, you know, especially scenes with the arm wrestling scene. That's really
one of the ones really I hate effective. The most is it's a little bit earlier in the film. It's definitely not when he's like fully flyified, but when he pulls his goddamn fingernails off, I hate that.
Yeah,
I hate that so much.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant.
also, when he pulls his tooth out, I don't hate that as much as the fingernail, but
yeah,
don't like that.
The Thing is another film that's lauded for its practical effects, which were I think, some of the best in cinema.
Yeah, definitely.
I adore that film. It is so well done, and the practical effects are just so, like, the scene where, like, he goes to use the defibrillator and the chest and opens up into a mouth,
yeah,
bites off his arm. Resetting that took an entire day.
Absolutely, it would. That's... It's one of those things where growing up in the generation where, I guess for us, it was kind of the transition period. Plenty of films in the 90s were still using a lot of practical effects because CGI hadn't quite got there. But kind of growing up in the generation where CGI started to become king is one of those things that, you know, it spoils you a little bit, I think, on practical effects. But I always watch these things with that in mind, in really appreciating the sheer amount of effort that went into making them, which is, like, I'm a fan of, I made you watch recently a Ray Harryhausen film, but I'm a fan of his claymation. We watched Jason and the Argonauts together.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Ray Harryhausen's work, which goes back to the 40s and forward into about the 80s, I think. Huge sidetrack, but goddamn, love practical effects.
Yeah. Oh, no, we were talking about something just before that.
Slither.
Yes. So, like, Slither has this cover where there's a woman in a bath and one of those leeches, which isn't, you know, as upfront about, you know, what it's going to be, but the image is just so well done, how it's this bathroom white, slightly blue. You can see the person in the bath. So you get that, you know, the color of their hair and their skin. And then there's this red, juicy, squelching looking leech thing. And it's
the cover, a wonderful image. Wet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember seeing
not that, just because it's a bath.
Yeah. I remember seeing the cover for Slither a lot when I would go and get DVDs when I was like 14 or whatever from the DVD store, then the nearest United Video as well in my case. But always, like, going down the horror aisle, and this was a little bit before I really got into it as a genre, I would usually kind of gravitate more to, you know, action or comedy films or something like that. But I'd walk down, and that was one of the ones that would catch my eye all the time, and I knew I didn't want to watch that. I knew that was going to make me too uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I knew that was going to be gross, and I wasn't going to like it.
Yeah. So we can contrast something like that, which has this very... It doesn't tell you what the film is about. It rather is an image that there is quite a bit to read into, that really does kind of whet the appetite. And you can contrast that with, this is jumping media, but Carcass, with their first, like, album and EP, Reek of Putrefaction and Songs of Suffering?
I think so.
Well, Song of Sickness, something like that, which they are some of the most evocative covers in metal, being collages of images taken from coroner's reports and autopsies, postmortems, synonyms. It definitely does a great job of priming somebody for what they're about to listen to. And it does it in a very upfront way.
Yeah.
And both are very interesting ways of going about presenting for the audience what's coming.
I would take, for example, if you're going to draw the line to an album, maybe Cannibal Corpse's first album.
Yes.
Eaten Back to Life, yeah.
Yeah.
It took me a second. I thought it was Feasted, but no.
Yeah. And that has a zombie eating itself.
Yeah. Eating itself back to life.
Yeah. It takes this very literal spin on the name of the album. And... you know, that image combined with their logo, which is that, like, splattery-looking, hard-to-read font. But it's actually not that hard to read.
It's but legible that, compared to a lot of later death metal.
And combine that image with the splattery logo for the band, you've got a very made-up image. Then you have Carcass, which you look at and you think, this is almost illegal. You know, it's using real-world horror in one of the worst kinds of it, which is depictions of death. and depictions of suffering in a way to elicit and prime the listener in a way that's incredibly effective. Whether or not it was good is a different discussion as to what it does and how it does it.
Yeah, that is true of pretty much all death metal.
Yeah.
At least the brutal, splattery side of things.
Yeah. And, you know, whether or not it's good is a completely subjective discussion. I think that they were really good album covers from Carcass. I hate looking at them.
They set out to achieve a goal.
And
that goal was absolutely achieved.
Yeah.
Is, I think, the best way to put it.
Yeah.
If you're trying to tread like a neutral path there, I think that's the most effective way to put it.
Yeah. I still hate looking at them. I'd maybe own one of the censored album covers. So I didn't have to look at it.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, you can look at it on a phone screen and you're like, I can't make out any of the details. I can make out the, because they made a face that has these, you know, tendril looking things. When you see a smaller version of it, you can see that image, and it's quite a haunting image from a distance. If you look at it closer, it's viscerally upsetting.
It's not a happy thing to look at.
No, it really isn't.
But I think that brings us naturally to the kind of final point of this introductory episode, getting the feeling for what this show is going to be. And that's, you know, the world as a horrible place. The horror we make, the horror that we brutalize ourselves with, comes from the horror that we experience and see, the horror of the real, as it were, if I was going to put on a wanky academic way of putting it. That is something that's kind of inescapable, because so much of the horror we interact with is directly or indirectly inspired by real things. And the sheer breadth of the kind of horrors that happen in the real world creates this kind of endless pool from which, you know, this bottomless pool from which to dip from to draw inspiration. I was saying, you know, way back earlier in the episode that horror could be the horror of war, or it could be the horror of some one individual doing a horrible thing, which, you know, the figure of the serial killer is the most recognizable form of that, the one that most people will think of. And these are all things that coexist with each other. They don't really happen in isolation at the same time as there are terrible wars happening somewhere and terrible things are being done or terrible circumstances are playing out because of them. At the same time as there are, say, natural or industrial disasters in which terrible things happen to the people who happen to be there, is exactly when there are individuals somewhere in the world doing horrible things to other people, and in some circumstances to themselves. You know, the final album that we touched on the old show was by Kettle Cadaver, whose frontman was famous for having a very high pain tolerance and a very unnerved mind.
He was not well.
He was not a well person. And those things clashed together in the stage performance, which we're going to get into now, but I think you can generally get the point from putting it that way. But also, there isn't just like the real things that we do. There are the things that we, I would put it, invent in the real world. We don't invent them as fictions. We invent them as ways to understand the world. A lot of conspiracy theories, for example, and that's a topic that is probably being discussed now over the last couple of years, more so than ever, in, you know, the discourse, you know, doing the little finger things right here, the discourse. But if you delve into how a lot of people use conspiracy theories to understand the world, they are conjuring a very terrifying world in which they live. The classic example, to use one that's, you know, not quite contemporary to now, but presages it, is the Satanic Panic. where people were conjuring these horrifying things happening in the world and convincing themselves that they were really, really happening. And that made for not a place in which someone was surrounding themselves with horrible artwork, but surrounding themselves with things that they knew weren't real. They were conjuring for themselves in their mind this horrible world in which they really did live. They made these horrors real for themselves. And that, you know, stretches both backwards and forwards in terms of, you know, the world that conspiracy theorists can make for themselves
yeah.
with certain conspiracy theories.
And there are unfortunate casualties of, you know, conspiracy
yeah,
theories.
Absolutely.
We are exposed to these things now because of social media in a way that really didn't exist for, you know, back in the Satanic Panic, which was largely propagated by kind of news outlets and also traditional God-fearing Christian households where kids started playing D&D and parents finding the books, looking at it. This book is full of demons and magic. This is witchcraft. This is dangerous. And so it was banned in a lot of schools. It was, yeah, a lot of kids were warned about it and told to stay away from it. And one of the ironic things about that was that Gary Gygax, one of the names responsible for it, was a devout Christian and was very active on like Christian message boards and, you know, had these very strong beliefs, but created this artwork. Well, actually, he didn't create that much. He was really good at surrounding himself with creative people and really good at building the branding company.
Tying their creativity together, as it were.
Yeah. But, you know he was keeping this separate from his personal convictions.
Yeah. This was something that was, if not a creative outlet, at least a business for him.
Yeah. So it was a little ironic that that was one of the things that got, you know, picked up during the Satanic Panic.
And I mean, if you sail back, you know, much further back to, say, the Salem Witch Trials, which were essentially a Satanic Panic occurring in the context of religious upheavals, which were being exported to the New World, as well as, you know, happening in the middle of Europe, you have something where both the real and the imagined real came together. The Salem Witch Trials and what happened during them, which led to the execution of many women, were a horrible and horrifying thing. But at the same time, the reason they happened was because people had convinced themselves of this horrible reality in which people with mystical powers were engaging in pacts with Satan to unleash kind of nefarious plots on the good people of, in that case, Salem. But in the way they viewed it, it was kind of a general thing. Salem was a microcosm of this happening to God-fearing people all over the place. And in that way, a imagined real and a real real, which I'm sure as the show goes on we'll find more eloquent ways of putting that, came together to create something that was both. And of course, if you were to look for movies about Salem witch trials, you're going to find some budget horror movies here and there. If you were looking for albums, there are probably plenty of, I mean, I know that there are at least some fairly good metal albums which touch on the Salem witch trials.
I mean, there's the band Abigail Williams.
Yeah, there we go.
And for films, Lords of Salem, which was a Rob Zombie film.
Great Rob Zombie song as well. Love Rob yeah. Lords of Salem, which I forget which album that came off, but that is a great song. But yeah it crossed over the borderland.
Mm. There's also a really interesting discussion to have surrounding ethnic prejudice with the Salem witch trials, as one of the convicted was a Haitian woman. And in Haitian tradition, there is, you know, what was labeled in by, you know, Christians as witchcraft. And one of the people was somebody who did practice Haitian traditions. And
which in and of itself was a mishmash of Western African spiritual and cultural practices, which merge together in the context of Haitian slavery.
Yeah.
Which, if you're going to talk about horrifying things in real life, in terms of slavery, it didn't get much worse than there.
Yeah. Yeah, it really didn't. Also, part of what was being observed with the victims, in air quotes, of the witchcraft were the, like, classic signs of the psychosomatic hysteria. There are, you know, symptoms of it that, for some reason, when psychologically and cognitively people believe that they are being possessed, you know, there were these, like, skin rashes, bloating of the belly was a huge one, kind of literally, where somebody that was very slight suddenly would become incredibly distended in the belly, and these kind of unconscious vocalizations and spasms of the vocal folds would hold them shut, but then this force would also be exerted on the diaphragm that would expel air, and people would make these screeches and these growls that by normal means people would have an incredibly difficult time recreating. Perhaps Diamond Glass would find it relatively easy.
Someone who had trained for a very long time to be able to do something like that.
Yeah. There were a lot of similarities between the people suffering from this hysteria and also people in real life who believe that they are possessed by demons and get exorcisms. There are a lot of similar features. There are psychosomatic manifestation that gets read as a demonic and evil force that sadly both have led to loss of life.
Like with this case, is one that has a very clear religious dynamic, and not all conspiracy theories that lead to someone or you know, outbreaks of paranoia or hysteria or however you want to put it. I know hysteria is kind of an old word these days, but c'est la vie, it's kind of the word we've got to get across this kind of, you know, mass psychosis, I suppose. But the, you know, religious angle gives it a particular religious and cultural flavor that can bestow upon events a greater meaning, but it's by far and away not the only way in which people trap themselves in these terrifying worlds. And if you look at some of the beliefs of QAnon and adjacent conspiracies today, especially when you're talking about Pizzagate, which is kind of came about right before QAnon, but and kind of got folded into it, a lot of the same people believed both. There's this entire world in which not only are there at the base level powerful people using their power to do terrible things, which is a completely rational thing to be afraid of, but the degree of how terrible they are, the kinds of things they do and why they do them, is blown out to these immense world-shaking proportions, to these unspeakable acts that feel as though they could only be imagined, and in many cases are things that couldn't rationally happen. I think about the Mole Children conspiracy about thousands and thousands of mutated, abused children being held in tunnels all over the US, particularly under places like New York, being abused to withdraw, you know, the whole adrenochrome conspiracy that you can withdraw a certain substance from abused children that is hallucinatory and stimulating in nature, which obviously isn't real, but it is a way in which people construct a reason for the perceived terrible things that they think are happening behind closed doors, behind the curtains. They come up with higher and higher order levels to these stories and these ways of understanding the world that crush them in ever greater amounts of horror and existential dread, and it becomes horror as a way to look at the world. I think there are ways in which horror can rationally be used to understand the world, but that is where you kind of use horror as a framing for real life events. For example, I think horror can be very useful in certain situations when describing particular events that happened during warfare. There was a battle during World War I on the Eastern Front between German forces and Russian forces in central Poland over a particular fort, and I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it's well known as the supposed Attack of the Dead Men. Is if you look that up, you'll find it fairly easily. And that was an instance of chemical warfare where the Russian garrison of this particular fortress was struck with a fairly catastrophic chlorine attack, as well as shelling, and it caused horrendous casualties, upwards of 50% of people knocked out of combat effectiveness for sure, many of whom died. But a very small contingent of the survivors rallied and sallied out of their defensive fortifications and launched a very localized, because we're talking about a few dozen people, charge against one of the German lines. And their one still being alive and their physical visage, because these are people whose lungs are dissolving and they're visibly coughing up organ matter and blood. They're skin has been affected by the irritants in chemical gas in the chemical being used. I think it was a chlorine gas attack, but it might have been one of the other ones that was used during World War I. Gave them this what was later called a zombified appearance, because their skin was peeling and blistering. They clearly weren't really breathing right. They were coughing up organ matter and viscera, and yet they were sallying out and attacking this line, and it caused a rout in the German forces, which stalled the capture of the fortress for, I think, only a day or two. But we have to use horror to really try and conceptualize the full scope of that situation, because just saying that they were injured or that they had been reduced to X amount of combat efficiency or describing the individual injuries isn't quite enough. These men had been turned into the walking dead. And for a lot of them, they were on the verge of death, and they probably did die over the course of that attempted sally, you know, that attempt to break out of their position and successfully rout the German forces. And, you know, this was enough that one of the guns of the fortress was able to be brought back into commission by some of the survivors and start blasting away at the retreating forces, which caused a small general rout in one section of the field and, you know, forestalled the capture of that castle for, I believe, a few days. It wasn't very long. But a particular event like that, horror, when applied to a real-life event, is very useful. But there's a very close tie between how we are using the horror and the event and what we know about it. So I think horror can be useful in that way, but there are plenty of ways in which horror kind of in of itself is subbed in as a way to understand the world. Another way I think that occurs is the very related phenomena of cult beliefs, where especially apocalyptic cults, but a lot of cults, once they get to a point where more and more control is needed, they're feeling more pressure from the outside, will resort to more and more drastic ways of understanding the world and more and more frightening ways of viewing how they, as this usually isolated community, or at least a fringe community that isn't, you know, in their eyes fully understood by everyone else, understands their relationship with those people. There are countless examples of cults that had a apocalyptic vision that could only be described as horrifying, or cults which took their beliefs to a destructive urge in order to fortify the standing of the cult. And, you know, I think that's another realm in which horror gets used to create a version of the real that isn't real. I rambled again.
No, that's all right. Especially that last point that you brought up with cults is also something that in horror films is explored. Particularly a film by Kevin Smith basically retells the ATF attack on the Branch Davidians.
Red State. There you go, Red State.
Yeah, which the Branch Davidians were a cult that was led by David Koresh, who was responsible for abusing a lot of people in the cult. Absolutely not a good person. They were also stockpiling weapons, preparing for an apocalyptic future. The ATF didn't like that. And there was a siege that unfortunately led to the demise of many of the members of the cult. A horrific attack that the ATF and FBI set fire to the compound in which they lived.
It was a botched attempt. A very botched attempt.
It was horrid thing to happen, but it's explored in Red State. Also, Jonestown is explored in a documentary that was made by Vice. Not a documentary, a film, which was a found footage kind of retelling of Jonestown. Real life informs horror films and horror media. And horror media can be used as a way to conceptualize real-world events.
And sometimes the real-world event is horror media. I think if you go back and you look at the... because you can still find some of the footage that Heaven's Gate put out, both as part of their quote-unquote exit statement, but also some of just the old promotional VHSs that were put out that would have Doe, the leader, Marshall Applewhite, was known as Doe, would be sort of rambling about the cult's beliefs and their particular interpretation of a kind of UFO Christianity. But that, once you have the context of the unfortunate mass suicide that occurred at the Heaven's Gate compound, brings horror into what might otherwise not really be horrifying footage. I think, you know, the actual exit statements themselves are horrifying because these are people who are very visibly and willingly walking into their final moments and seem very happy about it. And that in and of itself is a very horrifying thing. But even footage that isn't related to the exit statement takes on this horrifying context that changes what the initial feeling you would have and the initial meaning of those kind of video promotional lectures would have been. I find it even the more horrifying because a lot of the kind of Heaven's Gate mythos that Applewhite built up did have this kind of UFO utopian urge to it, and that it ended in such a way, you know, once again kind of curves back time and makes what was previously made more horrifying because you know how it ended.
To get a sense of how, you know, people don't half-heartedly walk into a lot of these things. You know, they give their lives literally for their beliefs. And one thing that in the aftermath of Heaven's Gate was the followers that lived as a way to continue the teachings, a lot of them expressed deep regret because the reason that they sadly died was because they believed that there was a alien craft that would be passing close to Earth, and that
disguised as Halley's Comet,
that when they died they would ascend and be
they were with. Going to the next level.
Yeah, they were leveling up. And so for the ones who weren't among the people that died, they lost that chance. And it's something that a lot of them held that belief for a very long time. There are probably still some that do.
There are a couple still around to maintain the website and who you can... I don't know if you can email them through the website, but there's a post box. You can send letters to them and ask about the Heaven's Gate sort of canon, I suppose. And that is the sort of thing that would haunt you, would stay with you. They are, you know, those who remained, and I'm pretty sure it's only like two or three people, but those who remained are kind of permanently entrenched in this world now. There isn't really an exit point for them anymore, because the kind of climactic final event of that belief system has happened, and, you know, the unfortunate end of Heaven's Gate came. And for them, that kind of played out the entirety of the belief system. For them, everything happened as it was meant to. And so they're kind of permanently stuck in this world that Marshall Applewhite, and I cannot remember his wife's name, the one that went by Tay.
T.
Built as kind of their permanent framework for the world now, for presumably the rest of their lives. And it's still possible that one or two of them who still remain might one day simply give it up and go about, you know, the remainder of their lives, but it seems fairly unlikely.
I think I agree.
Yeah, the last thing, I suppose, is the kind of real-world horror that is most familiar, and that's horrible crimes that are done. That's one that is kind of most directly tied to horror. The sheer number of slasher films that either draw direct inspiration from one serial killer or another, or draw indirect because they're inspired by a film that drew direct inspiration from one serial killer or another. It covers nearly the entire genre. And there are plenty of psychological horrors and thrillers and other such related films wherein, if it's kind of a human monster being portrayed, then the chances are there's some kind of at least osmotic inspiration coming from the real life crimes of people. There's no need now, I think, to get into any like individual serial killers, but I think there is, you know, a few different kinds, as it were. At the very least, I think there's a difference between kind of the modern sort of Jack the Ripper onwards to now, your Jeffrey Dahmers and Ed Kempers and Ed Gein's. Ed Gein's. Thank you for pronouncing that right. And plenty others, the butcher of this place or that place, the vampire of insert. And then I think there's also the kind of historical, not necessarily, but usually kind of aristocratic or noble serial killer, your Countess Bathory, your Giles de Rais, the French nobleman from Brittany, who was a companion of Joan of Arc, but was also a terrible serial killer, and others. There are more than those. Crime Prince Sado of Korea, who lived in the late 18th century and became infamous for killing a lot of his servants and you know, abusing a lot of his servants. And there are a few others. There's kind of a difference between them. In one case, it is kind of this faceless everyman or woman, and in the other, it is kind of this figure who was protected by power and who utilizes that power to perform terrible acts for one reason or another. I guess there's also kind of a subvariance, as it were, of serial killer based on motivation, of which I think the one that most people would recognize as its own thing are the kind of angels of death, people like Harold Shipman or various, you know, medical figures who have committed what might be called involuntary euthanasia of the people in their care, which is arguably one of the most tragic forms, precisely because of their position and what they're meant to do and the kind of betrayal of that. But what I think is my main point is that that kind of human monster, there are different versions of it. It isn't just kind of one monolithic. Everyone is some variation of Jack the Ripper. I think there's more to it than that.
There is a lot to talk about, but this is one episode of many that we plan to come. Are there any last thoughts that you have?
I don't think there's any finishing thoughts. I think we can wrap it up there. This is only the inaugural episode, and future episodes will be much more lasered in, much more focused than this one. This is kind of here to give you the feel for the breadth of topics that we're going to cover in this show. But we'll leave it at that, and you'll hear from us next time.
More of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.